This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. As always, Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you for the next hour alongside my producer, Lee Delapina. We are coming to you from our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and once again have the opportunity to visit with a couple individuals who help make this sport a success. And each and every week, I tell you, it's about the trainers in our game, those individuals who dedicate their lives to this sport that we love so much, and they dedicate it 24/7, 365 days of year, and tonight's guests certainly no exception. We're going to kick things off tonight with a young trainer, only in his mid-30s. He's already saddled 23 winners, 20 of those coming right here in 2014. Among those 23 winners are two graded stakes victories, so you can bet he knows how to train a good horse, and he is with us tonight. He is trainer Ben Colebrook, and he kicks things off for us on today's edition of Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you on board. And I'll tell you what, you look back on those numbers from this year, it's been a pretty good year, my friend.
Yeah, it really has. I was kind of surprised, on how well the stable's done this year, but pleasantly surprised. And, everything's kind of been clicking, so very happy.
Surprised? You weren't expecting this type of year?
Well, I mean, I kind of thought if maybe I could run out, $500,000 in earnings and, probably maybe 10 or 15 wins off of what I did last year, I thought that would be kind of a successful year. But I mean, obviously it's been a little bit better than I expected, but we've got some of the right horses in the barn, and that's definitely helped.
What's been the most rewarding part of this early success that you're experiencing?
I think just being able to win a graded stakes obviously was kind of the biggest thing. You always hope to get, those kind of horses in the barn. Being able to do it for a guy like Mr. Seltzer and Beverly Anderson was really good, because they've been there almost from the beginning supporting me with horses. And it was just extra rewarding to do it for them. That was the biggest thing this year, for sure. The most rewarding thing is having a filly like Sparkling Review in the barn.
Yeah, Sparkling Review taking the Pinoak Valley View earlier this year at Keeneland, and then going on to Churchill and taking the Grade 2 Mrs. Revere Stakes. So pretty good filly. And, Keeneland's been pretty good to you, Ben, because that's where you ultimately had your first winner, and now you come back and get your first graded stakes win there. Keeneland's been okay.
Yeah, well, that's extra sweet at Keeneland, because I've been coming here since I was a kid, going to the races with my dad, stuff like that. So, I mean, to win at Keeneland is always special, and to win a graded stakes at Keeneland and to have my first winner, lucky enough to have it at Keeneland, I mean, it's like a dream come true. So I'm just a very lucky guy.
Well, you mentioned going to the races with your dad as a kid. Take me back to the beginning, and where did it all start for Ben Colebrook?
I mean, to be honest, I can't ever remember not being around horses. I've been around them since my whole life. My dad managed farms and worked on farms and trained some horses when I was growing up, and I always rode and was always around horses. So I don't even really remember not being around horses. I mean, it's just always kind of been there and been something I've been involved with. So, I don't remember going to the races for the first time. I think, it's just I was always going to the races, so I remember some things, like my dad would take me out of school sometimes on Fridays and go to Keeneland, but I went to school in Versailles, so I mean, you know, I wasn't the only kid that was doing that. You know, a lot of the parents would come get their kids and pick them up early and take them out to Keeneland and stuff. But you know, it's always been there, and my whole life, it's just something that I've always done and always been involved in.
Yeah, your dad John involved for a very long time. Tell me a little bit more about your dad and the influence that he had on you in those early days.
Well, I mean, you know, I think it was more. It was, I mean, he definitely taught me a lot about, you know, just everything, you know, the overall care of horses and just, you know, just the initial lessons that you learn on, you know, just how to handle horses, how to ride, how to, you know, just those kind of things. You know, then I kind of, you know, went my own route. I mean, you know, when I got, you know, out of high school, I kind of started to do a little bit of more of my own thing, and but definitely the early lessons he definitely taught me, kind of, you know, everything, the you know, my whole background, and you know, just kind of the early lessons on horsemanship and, you know, just horse management and stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I played baseball growing up, and my dad was my coach in my very young years, and then after I got too old for my dad to coach me anymore, I started going off on a different direction, just like you said, kind of doing my own thing. And I can remember that my dad would try to tell me something, and I didn't want to hear it. But if my coaches told me the very same thing, it was gospel, even though it was the same thing my dad was telling me that I didn't want to listen to. Was there ever any of that element involved with your relationship with your dad when you started going off on your own?
No, I don't know. Not necessarily. I don't think it was really like that. It was just more, you know, I was just doing my own thing. He was doing his own thing. And it was, you know, I mean, we talked about it, but at the end of the day, I don't think really, no, I don't think if he kind of told me something, I probably listened early on. Maybe I didn't. I don't know. You know, your teenage years, you're pretty stubborn. So probably not. I probably did my own thing. But I think you learn, to be honest, I think you learn more from the horses than it from any one person. Kind of, you know, the horses teach you a lot. Just, if you pay attention, I think you learn a lot from just each horse, and kind of what worked with one might not work for the next. Or if you know something about, you know, something that may work for one that had the same kind of temperament or something, then maybe that might work for another one down the road. I mean, I think that the horses definitely are where you learn.
That's interesting. It makes you sound like a horse whisperer when you say that.
I don't know about all that, but I just think that horses kind of, I think you need to learn from the horses and just pay attention to the horses, and they'll teach you. And maybe not teach you, but just if you put like little things in the back of your mind, you know, that, you know, that maybe worked, and maybe, you know, down the road it'll serve you well, because maybe it might work again for one, or maybe it won't, but at least you can try it, you know.
Can you recall a specific lesson that you've learned from a horse or from horses that you never saw coming? You didn't expect to learn these things about horses, but somehow they taught it to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if any particular horse, but going back to, you know, I spent a lot of time breaking yearling, you know, when I was a kid and stuff. So I think more than maybe one horse, I mean, there were some difficult horses that I was, you know, breaking, and just stuff that I learned from them. Probably, I mean, Storm Flag Flying was one. I guess if I had to pick one horse, it would probably her. I broke her when I was working for Bill Harrigan at Maya Comet Farm, and, you know, she was very, very difficult. And some of the stuff that we did with her, that, you know, just her temperament, just trying to get along with her and not fight with her, because if it ever came down to a fight, you weren't going to win. So I guess probably she would have been the one horse that I can remember most that, you know, I learned a lot from, and just how to try to get along with her, and, you know, not make it a fight, and try to get her to do things with her thinking it was her idea, not your idea.
And I can imagine, Ben, that a lesson like that serves you well when you're working with so many horses on your own now. And I'm sure there are times when you remember that experience when you're working with a horse that might be a bit stubborn at this point in your career.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, luckily I haven't had to deal with one as difficult as her yet. But, you know, I definitely think, you know, that some of the stuff, you know, difficult fillies, some of the stuff that issues that she had, you know, you definitely can relate to other fillies, or you know, because they can be moody at times, and, you know, just don't want to do what you want at that time. And I think if you just kind of take your time and be patient and just try to not make it a fight, I think you do better than if you know, especially with the Phillies, if you get in a fight with them, a lot of times you're not going to win.
Ben Colebrook joining me on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Ben, you mentioned the name Bill Harrigan. Was that your first official job kind of on your own after you ended up leaving your dad and working with your dad?
No, not really the first official one. I mean, I broke up yearlings for a few different farms and stuff, but I worked for him the longest. I was my longest tenure was with him after I kind of went on my own. I spent quite a few years at my Comet breaking yearlings, you know, because at the time, you know, he was breaking all the Phipps horses and horses for Lane's End, and, you know, a lot of really, really good horses came through, Mineshaft and Storm Flag Flying. And I mean, there was just every, you know, Good Reward. There was a lot of really, really good horses that came through the pipeline while we were there. So that was kind of neat just to be around that quality of horse.
Yeah, you know? How about that? As a kid just growing up loving horses and following the sport, to be able to work with those types of horses, those are some pretty big names that you just mentioned. That had to be a cool experience.
Yeah, that was really, really neat, you know, to be around, you know, horses that were, you know, ended up being Eclipse Award winners. And at the time, you know, they were just unbroken yearlings. And I mean, it was really neat to kind of follow their careers from afar. You know, I mean, you know, obviously when they were running and stuff, you didn't have anything to do with them, but, you know, kind of, you always kind of followed them because you did have a small part of it, you know.
Just to clarify the timeline, was that time you spent with Bill Harrigan before or after you attended the University of Kentucky?
During the same time. Yeah.
Same time.
Yeah.
Was that the kind of same situation? You'd skip out on Fridays to go work with Bill?
No, I kind of had it a little bit scheduled a little bit better, but I would still skip out on Fridays and go to Keeneland sometimes.
did you actually take your classes and set your classes around Keeneland and horse racing?
Yeah. I tried to do it as best I could. You know, I mean, it did get difficult to kind of plan it. I mean, early on, it was easy when you're just taking, you know, general electives and stuff like that. It was much easier because, you know, they're offered at a lot of different hours. But, you know, as I got further along, it was a little bit more difficult to try to find the time. And at that point, I was getting more, you know, more involved in it, spending more time with the horses. And, you know, I kind of at that point knew that was going to be my career, where early on, I wasn't really sure in the beginning, I just thought it was a good way to kind of have a part-time job to pay for school and get through school. And I was a little bit unsure if I really wanted, I knew how hard it was to make a living, in the horse business. So, you know, I kind of thought maybe I'd just go to school and get another career, but
really,
I had the bug a little bit too much and couldn't kick it.
What was your major at UK?
Just business major.
All right. So you were actually thinking that maybe there might be something else out there for
you? I think
I
was trying to convince myself more than anything else. Trying to convince myself that I didn't want to do it, but there was just too much. I think, like I said, that it was, I was just, you know, had the bug a little bit too much. The horse bug had a hold of me by that point.
So do you still follow the Wildcats?
Oh, yeah, big time. Yeah.
Bleed blue.
Bleed blue for sure. Yeah.
Ben Colebrook here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. All right, so you leave Bill Harrigan, and then I guess you spent a little time working with Fred Seitz as well?
Yes, that was kind of I left in Bill and went to work for Fred Seitz I started as an exercise rider and then ended up being like his first assistant. And I spent, you know, around 3 years with him. That was, you know, it was great to kind of be around, you know, Fred's a great guy and a really good, you know, good horseman and, you know, knows a lot about the business and has been in all facets of the business. So, I learned a lot while I was there as well.
Yeah. What's the one thing you would say that you took away from working with Fred that you're still employing in your operation today?
I think a lot of it was just, he's such a good, he's a very good people person and very honest. I think that was a lot of it, you know, just treat people the right way. And, I think that was the biggest lesson I learned from him, is just how to conduct yourself and be, you know, he's very, very professional. I think a lot of that was what I picked up from him.
So after you left working with Fred, what led to the decision to leave that operation and move on from there?
Well, I got to know, I mean, I'd met Christoph working for Bill Harrigan, because Bill Harrigan and my comment do all their all Christoph's layups and stuff. So I had met Christoph quite a few times over the years, and he kind of always said, you know, if you ever wanted to, you know, move on and, you know, get a, you know, work for a bigger stable and be an assistant, you know, that he would, you know, he would give me a job. And it came to a point where, you know, kind of it was time to, I mean, Fred's was a good job, but I needed to work for a bigger, you know, a bigger stable, you know, and get a little bit more exposure, I guess, was kind of the main thing, you know, with the outfit like Christoph's. You know, I mean, there's so many good horses every year, and, you know, you get to meet the right people and, you know, be around, you know, top class horses. So there was just a point where I think that I needed to try it. And, you know, so I did. It was a great experience working for Christoph. I mean, he's been very, very good to me, both while I was working for him and also since I've gone on my own. He was very supportive when I went on my own.
Talking, of course, about trainer Christoph Clément. How, Ben, would you describe your relationship with Christoph?
I mean, I had a very good relationship with him, and we still talk quite a bit. You know, he's when I won the stake, you know, he always calls or sends a text. And, I mean, I think he's, you know, happy that I'm doing well, and he's also been, you know, very, very supportive of me since I've been on my own. And just I think very good relationship, and nothing bad to say about him.
Yeah, have you gone to him over the years or in the time that you've been on your own and tried to bounce a few ideas off of him, or said, hey, Christoph, can I run this by you? Anything like that?
Not really. No, I mean, no, he's a very busy guy and very intense and very, you know, occupied with his own horses. Now, I was with him for a pretty long time, 4.5 years, so I kind of definitely, some of the stuff I do or some of the, you know, things that, you know, some of the training decisions that I make are definitely influenced by him, but I don't like call him and ask him, you know, just because I don't think he's got enough on his plate to not have to worry about my horses.
Well, but, he's had so much success. Were you there for the Gio Ponti years as well?
Oh yeah. I started when that was kind of one of the main reasons I wanted to go to work for him, was because Gio Ponti was a 2-year-old. That fall he ran at Keeneland, and I saw the race at Keeneland. I was like, wow, this horse could be a really, really nice horse. And we had already talked about maybe me going to work for him at some point. So I went to work for him that winter of Gio Ponti's 3-year-old year.
How emotional were those wins for Gio Ponti, especially after the passing of Dr. Tony Ryan at Castleton Lions, who, of course, owned Gio Ponti?
Well, I think it was a big, big deal for everybody at the farm, and, you know, for obviously for Shane, you know, to kind of, after his father passed away, I mean, I think it was great that they were able to come up with such a good horse so fast. And I mean, basically, you know, he's been such a big deal for Castleton. Now he's standing there, you know, obviously as a stud, and I mean, off to a good start. I mean, it seems like he's off to a good start at the sales, and, you know, everybody, he's been very well received. So, I think it was a huge deal for everybody, you know, to have a multiple Eclipse Award winner, and just, you know, it's a horse that's like him that, you know, just was so reliable. I mean, you could, every time you let him over there, you knew he was going to run his race.
Do you ever get out to the farm to say hello?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely do. Yep. I actually have his half sister in the barn right now, Antonia Autumn.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, but I know I do go out and see him.
And any, you know, similarities with her and Gio Ponti?
Not a whole lot, really. No, not to be honest. I mean, they're not. She's a Bernstein, and I mean, if anything, she's probably more similar to Bernstein than Gio. She's a little bit more high strung than Gio. You know, she's always kind of on the muscle. Gio was pretty relaxed, especially before he raced. You know, I mean, he was real cool customer before. You know, like when you'd lead him over there before the race, he was like super focused and just really understood. I think he understood racing, you know what I mean? I don't think he wasted any energy before the race, and he was just a, you know, very, very professional horse. And you know, Antonia's not that she's not, but she's just a little bit high strung, you know, and training wise, she always wants to do a little too much, just on the muscle a bit more. But there's not a whole lot of similarities between them.
Visiting with Ben Colebrook on Trainer Talk presented by Fayzid Tipton. Ben, when did you make the move to go out on your own, and how did you know that it was the right time?
Well, I did it in August 1st of 2012, and, you know, I don't know how I knew. I mean, I think it just was a time where, I'd been with Christoph long enough, and, you know, Christoph was very good, and, you know, when I left, he gave me, you know, babies, two-year-olds of his to get ready. I mean, I really only had, like, two outside horses, and the rest were all Christoph's horses when I first started. So, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to do it without Christoph. So I just think that it was I was sick of traveling so much. My wife, or, you know, my fiance then, my wife now, was in Kentucky, and we had a house here, and I always knew that I wanted to, you know, if I was going to train, I wanted to train in Kentucky. And I just think it was a time where, you know, it was either like, are you going to do it? If you're going to do it, you need to do it now, you know, because there's never a good time, I don't think.
Yeah.
You got to make it happen and see how it goes. So I guess more than anything else, it was just, the timing was then. And it was like, just do it and see how it gets on. And if you make it, great. If not, there's always something else you can do.
Was your wife involved with horses too at the time?
No, she doesn't have any involvement. She works at Alltech, and she has no involvement in horses. She likes to go to the races, and she likes to, you know, come to the barn and be around the horses, but she has no involvement in it.
You know, I mentioned at the top of the show that this profession is 24/7, 365 days a year. How is she able to deal with you working every weekend and every holiday?
Well, it's been tough in the beginning, but I mean, you know, it just got to be something that she got kind of used to. I guess it's kind of how you, I mean, it hasn't been easy, but at the same time, she kind of knew when she met me what my life was about. And she kind of just made a decision like, okay, well, you know, that's what it is. And it is what it is, and we'll just work around it. And we're both pretty easygoing, low key people. So I think that's probably why it works. Don't get too stressed out about stuff and just kind of go with the flow, I guess.
I can imagine that is so important, especially with somebody like yourself, young in the business, just kind of getting started on your own, really. And to have that even keel disposition has to be huge, because let's face it, this is a game with wild mood swings, highs, lows, and you have to be on that even plane as much as you can.
Yeah, I mean, I try to be as much as I can. I mean, obviously, you know, there's some things that just set you off, obviously, but you're totally right that, you know, that the game itself is ups and downs and super highs and super lows. So I don't think you can get, you know, I try never get too high or too low. You know, I mean, you get beat, your horse runs terrible. I mean, you kind of got to brush it off and, you know, figure out, okay, well, what happened, and regroup. But if you go and you win a big race and, you kind of got to, the next morning, you still got to be at work and you still got to go through the barn. And I mean, the next day there might be something that's, you know, not right. And you just got to kind of deal with it and move on. But I think it's very important not to be on an emotional roller coaster, because, you know, the game itself is such a roller coaster ride, you know? So I think, you know, if you can kind of keep even and kind of keep steady, that you'll be much better off.
What's been your biggest challenge so far, Ben?
You know, I've been pretty, very lucky in the fact that I've gotten a lot of really good support from the right people. You know, people have sent me horses kind of right off the bat, and have had, you know, trusted me to kind of, you know, from a young trainer's point of view. I mean, it's been unbelievable, really, how everybody's kind of jumped on board pretty quick. The biggest challenge, I guess, is just the financial end of it. Just, you know, making payroll every week and, you know, just that part of it. I mean, it's tough to kind of, you know, deal with the business end of it, I guess, has been the biggest hurdle, because, I mean, I've been around the horses my whole life, so the horse part of it kind of came naturally, but, you know, dealing with the running a whole business has kind of been a, you know, it's been a bit of a learning curve. But I guess that's been the biggest challenge, to be honest.
You know, I've had the chance to visit with Hall of Famer Shug McGahee, Hall of Famer Ron McAnally on this program. And when you talk with those individuals, the thing that comes to mind is old school. And obviously, you being a young guy in your mid-30s, your approach, your ideas are going to be different than their ideas. Do you find yourself maybe being a little more, would you consider yourself to be more cutting edge maybe at this point in your career?
I mean, no.
No?
I think my approach is probably more old school, just because, I mean, the people that I've worked for over the years, I mean, Christoph's, you know, takes a pretty old school approach. I mean, he worked for Shug, he worked for Luca Kamani. I mean, he worked for, you know, he came up, Alec Head was kind of his mentor. So, I mean, I think the people that I've learned from have been more the old school approach, as far as like the horses. But I mean, I think,
what about like social media and websites and all that kind of stuff?
I'm starting to get more into that. I mean, my wife has a Twitter account for the stable and stuff. And I mean, she kind of manages that for me. And
what's the Twitter account, Ben?
At Colebrook Stable.
Okay.
But I mean, I don't get a lot really involved in it, but I mean, I think I probably should learn that more. I mean, I think, from the stable management stuff, I mean, I use computer programs to manage the stable and do all my billing and stuff like that. So, I mean, I do use computers a lot, and then watching races and, you know, I mean, you're on your iPhone all the time checking stuff. So I guess, I mean, I do use technology, but for as far as training horses, I would consider myself to have more of an old school approach. You know, I'm not trying not to, you know, have big vet bills and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, I think more patience and, you know, if the horse needs time, maybe just turn him out for a while or, you know, instead of, you know, trying to use all the, I mean, I do use some chiropractic stuff and, you know, stuff like that, I guess I use, but, as far as all the gadgets and stuff and all the stuff that's out there, I mean, I don't know that I use them as much as, you know, maybe other people.
Well, don't change a thing, because what you're doing seems to be working pretty well. You're off to a great start, and believe it or not, this half hour has flown by. We could spend more time, but we'll do a part two up the road when you really get things cranked up. And Ben, can't thank you enough for taking a little time here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
All right, buddy. All the best. Ben Colebrook here on Trainer Talk. And, boy, really energetic. And you could hear him in his voice, the enthusiasm he has for the sport. Interesting to hear him say that in his mid-30s, he still kind of considers himself to be old school. And I guess learning from a guy like Christoph will do that to you. He's learned from the best. There's no doubt about that. All right, second half of Trainer Talk coming up next here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And it is all presented by Fasig Tipton. Steve Dunn on deck next. Going to be fun. Stay tuned. It's never too early to start talking about the Fasig Tipton Florida sale. Mark your calendar now for this premier two-year-old and training sale on Wednesday, March 4th, with the Under Tax Show taking place Monday, March 2nd. 2014 graduates of the Florida sale include Grade 1 hopeful winner, Competitive Edge.
Competitive Edge makes it 2 for 2 here at the spa. Competitive Edge, the winner by 4.5 lengths.
Grade 2 Saratoga Special Hero, I Spent It.
I Spent It, a dramatic winner of the Saratoga Special.
And Blofeld, winner of the Grade 2 Futurity.
Blofeld at the rail. Here comes Blofeld to win the Futurity.
With the 2014 sale boasting the highest average and second highest median of all two-year-old sales, the Fasig Tipton Florida sale is the place to be. Nominations are now being accepted. So log on to FasigTipton.com and nominate today.
For racing coverage from the inside out.
I still kicked away and I thought I really had it until the 16th pole. Amazing little horse.
International English events.
A clear round and under the time limit will get you into the jump off.
And hard-fought Western competition.
Here we go, guys. Let's help him. You bet.
Woo! Tune in to HRTV, the network for horse sports. Online at HRTV.com.
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreds.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms, mgive.org/chi. Hey everyone, Mike Penna here along with jockey Christina McManigal, and do we have some big news for you.
Starting Tuesday, December 16th, you can join us for our brand new Jock Talk show from 6 to 7 Eastern.
Jock Talk? Sounds like that might be right up your alley, Christina.
Haha, you know it. Every Tuesday night, we'll give you a unique look into the lives and backgrounds of racing's top jockeys, both past and present.
It should be amazing, so join us every Tuesday night from 6 to 7 Eastern for Jock Talk beginning Tuesday, December 16th, streaming live and podcast exclusively on our HRN website, horseracingradio.net. Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Lee Delapina, my producer, we are with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios and want to extend a special welcome to everybody tuning in coast to coast throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM 206, and of course, everybody listening worldwide on our website, horseracingradio.net. Enjoyable visit with young Ben Colebrook in the first half of the program. Looking forward to the second half as I welcome in Steve Dunn here in just a moment, but do want to remind you that you can go to our website, horseracingradio.net, listen to podcasts of all of our Trainer Talk shows. Just click on the show tab at the top of the webpage, and you'll be taken to a page for Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton, and you can go all the way back through Shug McGahee, Todd Pletcher, Bill Mott, Ron McAnally, so many outstanding names that have been part of this program over the course of the past year plus, and really looking forward to continuing that trend here with Steve Dunn in the second half of the program tonight. Steve Dunn, the 58-year-old conditioner, has sent out 247 winners in his career. They've earned purses of more than $4 million, and he is fresh off a big win with the 6-year-old Indiana-bred gelding Buster Rose in the inaugural running of the Canterbury Stakes on the Claiming Crown program at Gulfstream Park this past weekend. By the way, that was a race we had for you right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, and Steve is with us now. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you back on board here. And, you know, that race by Buster Rose, as I mentioned, we were there right next to the paddock. The gentleman I was doing the show with loved Buster Rose before the race, and to see him perform the way he did was sensational. You described the race as special afterwards. How come?
Well, just coming from such humble roots and as he has, and not having an opportunity like on a yearly basis, not having opportunities like this to run in the Claiming Crown and races of that caliber. For us, for our little operation, our little blue collar operation, it was a great thrill. So it was special, and the fact that a year and a half ago Buster almost bled to death and died, and for him to kind of rise like that from death's door, and then not only come back and win, but win at this kind of level was a very emotional, special win for us.
Well, I didn't know the background on Buster Rose. Take me back through that just a little bit.
Well, he was sent to me by his owner and about a year and a half ago, and just through a series of a few physical things that he was doing, I thought something was wrong, we were getting close to figuring it out when he had had an aneurysm burst in his throat and almost bled to death, and we got him quickly to Haggard, and Dr. Hunt operated on him and saved his life, and he came back and kind of took a while to get his confidence. I think that's when we ran him for 10 a few times, for 10,000 claiming a few times, and he banged around a little bit with second and third and second, but the next start, that's all in December, a year ago this December, we ran him for 12.5 at Turfway, and he just exploded and just really, just like a different horse on that poly. And so we ended up running him a few more times at Turfway. We're third in the four go and second a couple ounce races, and we decided then we were going to put him away and wait on the grass and sprint him on the grass.
Yeah, you were quoted after the race as saying that for whatever reason, God made him to be a 5/8 of a mile on the grass type of horse. And boy, he certainly looked like he took to that like a duck to water on Saturday.
There's no question. I mean, did we think he was going to be this good? I don't think so. You know, I think we were just hoping he could bang out a little bit of bang out a race or two and make some money and just maybe have just a few more options in the condition book to available to him to run for. So for him to elevate and inflate his game to this level was it was truly special. It really was.
Steve, when you have a big win like that, you're obviously elated for yourself, but are you maybe even happier for the connections who gave you the opportunity to be part of this horse?
Oh, there's no question. There's absolutely no question. Mike Ball, he is a man that, had to take some pretty rough phone calls in the first 30 days that I started training for him. He's not one of them guys that wears short pants too much. I mean, he took it like a man, and he ponied up. And as I keep telling him, Mike, we stayed the course. You know, we stayed the course, and we were rewarded. And he's a class act, a class man, a wonderful, wonderful guy to deal with. You don't have to choose your words and tiptoe around anything. You know, you can just tell him like it is, and he gets it. And it's been a great relationship.
You know, so many times athletes will talk about the excitement and the butterflies they have before they go out for a big moment, whether it's the World Series, the Super Bowl, whatever it might be. I've even had jockeys tell me that they'll get that feeling in their stomach before they go out for a big race. How about you in the paddock before the race with Buster Rose? Were there a few anxious moments there for you?
Well, there's no question. It was funny because, I talking to my friends before the race, I said, I'm kind of a wound up kind of a guy before a race. I get anxious about, not really about the race and the competition, but I get anxious about being prepared for the competition and making sure all my I's are dotted, my T's are crossed. But actually, when it comes to the competition itself, I kind of get calm. Once we're heading to the paddock, I kind of calm down, and then, because it's all done, now it's time to go ahead and play the game. And so throw the rider up, and you just have to say, well, here we go. It's up to him and the jock and the racing god. You have a little luck, and, Saturday was our day, so it worked out well.
Well, fellow trainer Buff Bradley had a post on his Facebook page right after your win on Saturday, and he said, congrats to Stephen Dunn on his Claiming Crown Stakes win. It's good to see hardworking trainers getting the big wins. What's that mean to you?
Well, gosh, I mean, that means more than I can say, really. Whenever you're complimented by one of your peers, especially someone like Buff, who I've known since he was an assistant for Clarence Pikeu, he's worked hard his whole life, and come up through the ranks like we have, and you know, it means everything. And you know, to be recognized that way, you know, that means everything. So it was very, very humbling and gratifying to read that, and I thank Buff that post.
Talking with trainer Steve Dunn on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Steve, let's go back to the beginning, so to speak, and look back on your earliest memories of being around the races and going to the racetrack. Where did this journey start for Steve Dunn?
Well, I think my father trained horses, and I think my earliest recollection of being in a winner's circle picture was at Riverdance when I was like 4 years old.
Wow. Where's that picture now?
All my life.
Do you have that picture?
I do. I actually do. I have that picture. I do. It's on my mantle and prominently placed.
Wow. Now, all right, how is it possible that you have that picture, but you don't have the wind photo from Buster Rose yet?
Well, that's a good question. I had an 8 o'clock flight the very next day, and so I'm just kind of waiting on the mail to catch up with me. I need to get back. My wife and I run a little farm, and you know, it's time to grab the pitchfork and get back to work again. So,
what do you consider to be your most prized possession? I'm sure that picture ranks up there, but what's your most prized possession?
My family, my wife and kids. And that's what it's all about for me. I mean, we drew a line in the sand 20 years ago that, you know, family was going to come first. And so, you know, going up and down the road chasing Derby horses was out. And we were, you know, it was all about, you know, digging in and taking care of the kids and the family and doing the right thing by them, you know, by each other.
Are they involved with racing as well?
My children aren't, but my wife and I, my wife Elise, 31 years, we have worked together our entire marriage, and you know, that I would not, she's the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my life, was meeting my wife, and she's just truly a rock and a blessing to put up with it. And it takes a special woman to put up with the, you know, the nuances of the racetrack world and the way that we have to live and operate. But she's the best.
Did you meet her on the racetrack, or was this something that was completely separate?
I met her at Belmont Park.
Really?
Actually. Yep. Met her at Belmont Park. We were both working at Belmont, and I was just supposed to be there for the summer, but I met her and I stayed 6 years. So.
Funny how that works out.
Yeah. You don't, you know, sometimes God has other plans for you. You think you've got the answers, but there's other plans in place for you.
So the kids, though, they never had any interest in getting involved?
Well, they both know how to work, but my son's a junior at UK. He's majoring in business agriculture, and my daughter is she's a hairstylist for the Z Salon in Louisville. So, but they both know, they're both natural horsemen, but they've just chosen different paths, and quite a bit like my father wanted me to do, which I didn't listen very well. But you know, we kind of know how tough the business is, and it's a tough business. It's a very, very tough. It's hard on you emotionally too. I mean, you have to learn to lose 80% of the time and like it.
Yeah.
And the yo-yo effect of the racing, it's hard. It's not, and I think that's why there's quite a bit of attrition. There's a lot of people that love horses and just can't handle the emotional roller coaster that goes with it.
No, it's a game with the, I say it all the time, Steve, and it's kind of the old axiom with racing, the highest highs and the lowest lows, and you really have to have your big boy pants on when you're gonna play this game on any level.
Well, there's no question, and you know, and that's it's one thing that was hard for me to learn initially because I'm kind of mercurial and, you know, I'm a head first slider and I try to win at everything I've ever done in my life. And I play 120%. And it's hard to reconcile, like I say, you know, the losing 80% of the time and liking it and rationalize it in your head when, you know, you're kind of hardwired a different way and it takes some adjustment.
So when did you first know that this was something you wanted to pursue and that you wanted training horses to be your profession?
Well, I think I always wanted it. It was just that, you know, my parents always pushed us away from racing and wanted us to get away from it. And I bounced around doing other things and then just finally said, look, you know, I'm tired of trying to make everyone else happy. It's time for me to make myself happy. And this is what I want to do. And so, you know, we just kind of worked my way up through the ranks, galloping horses, being a foreman and assistant and then going on my own. And so that's like 23 years ago, we went on our own and we're still at it. So,
yeah. What do you remember about that day when you finally told your parents, hey, this is what I'm doing?
Well, it's kind of liberating. You know, you finally, just find enough, you know, strength to, you know, you want to please your parents and you want to please everybody around you. And you do a lot of things growing up that you think other people think you should be doing when, you know, you finally say, well, look, you know, I gotta look in the mirror and I gotta like what I see. So I'm gonna try to help this guy too. And I'm gonna do what I like.
Well, obviously as somebody who is always interested in the sport, I'm sure there were times early in your career before you really got started that you looked at other trainers and you said, boy, someday if I get into this, that's kind of the model I want to follow. Were there other trainers that you looked up to, Steve?
Very much so. First of all, my father, Bill Mott and Elliot Birch, galloped horses for Elliot in New York. And he was Alan Jerkins, played football in the horse path next to his barn in the afternoons after feed time. And, that's why I originally went to New York, is to see the trainers and see the horses and see the places I've just been reading about my whole life and try to learn a little different way of doing things. And so it worked out pretty well. I remember one thing that when I first started training is that whenever I looked at an overnight and I saw Bill Mott or Wayne Lucas or something, I thought, geez, you know, boy, I'm in a tough race. Just didn't even know the horses, just knew the trainers' names and thought, wow, I'm in a tough race.
Yeah.
And deep down in the pit of my stomach, I said, you know, one of these days I want to be one of those guys. I want that kind of respect. I want to be able to be on an overnight and somebody look and see my name and say, geez, you know, might be a tough race. And, you know, we've always tried to bring over a competitive horse and I think that in our own way, in our own small way, you know, we don't make 150, 200 starts a year. And, but, you know, I think that, you know, we've kind of achieved that sort of respect, on a local level that people, kind of know that, you know, we're out there to win, you know, we're going to be coming at you and, you know, and that's been gratifying to hear that back from jocks and jock agents and people that, you know, want to ride our horses.
You know, I can remember when I was a kid growing up around Saratoga, I would always chase after guys like Nick Zito and Dwayne Lucas and try to hunt them down for an autograph on my program. Have you ever had anybody come up to you and ask for an autograph?
Just once there was a up at Indiana Downs. I mean, at Hoosier Park, I'm sorry, not Indiana Downs, but at Hoosier Park, we ran, it was like Indiana Champions Day, and we ran four horses in four stakes, and we won three of them. And somebody, I don't know, Lucas actually gave away all the trophies that day, and somebody asked him for his autograph, and I got the piggyback. Somebody asked me for mine at the same time. So, I think it was secondhand autograph session.
Trainer Steve Dunn here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Steve, you mentioned the name Alan Jerkins, and when you did, you mentioned playing football outside the barn, and it seems like everybody that comes on this program and mentions Alan Jerkins somehow alludes to those football games, and that was very special at the time, wasn't it?
Oh, it was an honor. I mean, are you kidding me? I just spent some time with Chief down at Gulfstream. He was in the barn next to us where I was stabled for the claiming crown, and we visited. I went up and visited with him every day, you know, and he's a living legend, and to be able to be part of that, you know, we push his seat car down the shed road just so we could get in the game and you know, whatever it took to be around him, because he was just so full of wisdom, and he was a giant killer, man. He was one of the guys you want to be around and learn from.
Well, looking back on your career now, who would you say has had the biggest influence on making you the trainer you are now?
Probably my wife.
Yeah.
And not so much is the horsemanship part is the just being the sounding board in the back, the conscience of all the decision making that goes into it. But it's really just I try to take a little bit from everybody I was around. I took the things I liked from Lucas when I galloped horses for him, and from Elliot Burtz, and just the different people that I was around. You just try to glean what you like and incorporate it and make your own program, really, and make your own you create your own program that works for you, you know. But I think the biggest influence on me with the horses has been my wife, and that you know, we make a lot of decisions together, and she's a great sounding board, you know, just a whole different set of eyes and perspective, and it's been invaluable.
How would you describe your approach and your philosophy to training horses?
Well, the horse comes first. The horse comes first. I mean, you try to keep them as competitive as you can. You know, you hate overmatching them. You know, the old saying is, you know, you can have Alan Jerkins train them, Charlie Whittingham your groom, and Eddie R. Carroll can ride them, but if they're worth 20 and they're in for 50, you're getting beat.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a function of a lot of good decisions, but the horse comes first, and being able to gallop my own horses for 40 years has given me a good perspective on how they're doing and how they're acting, and my wife's always been in the barn in the stall and watching them from that perspective, and they talk if you listen, you know, if you just try to do the right thing every day. You know, you can't go wrong doing the right thing. You never can go wrong doing the right thing. And that's something we live by.
I've had a lot of trainers come on this program, and they'll talk about galloping their own horses like you do. And they say it gives them a huge advantage because they can feel what's going on with their equine athlete. And it sounds like you're in that same camp, that it really makes a big difference.
It really does. Sometimes exercise riders that you hire, sometimes they're eager to please. So they want to tell you what you want to hear. But, you know, you can always get on them yourself and know what you got and know how they're going, if they're moving forward or backing up on you. And it is. For me, it works. You know, for other people that have never galloped horses, there's a lot of great trainers out there. I mean, Shug and those guys, there's a ton of trainers out there that have never sat on a horse except maybe a pony, and they're in the Hall of Fame too. So, it goes back to what works for you.
Steve, for people listening to this show here tonight that might be thinking about getting involved with training horses, and they might be doing it as they get started on a much smaller level, what's the biggest challenge of operating a smaller operation as opposed to an operation like a Dwayne Lucas or a Nick Zito?
Well, I think it's just having enough horses to make it feasible, you know, and then having good clients to make sure that you get paid and you have enough money to operate. And the way the escalating costs of, you know, feed and hay and everything, it's a tough game. You better be willing to work. I mean, that's the thing going in. Until you can get enough cash flow to have a, you know, be able to afford the payroll that it takes to operate, and it is kind of a labor intensive business, and you better be able to roll up your sleeves and work.
As you were galloping horses for people in the early days, and even now still getting on horses, but was there a part of you at some point that said, maybe I'd like to try my hand at being a jockey?
When I was like 14, I started galloping when I was about 12. So when I was like 15 and everybody wanted me to ride, and I felt then I wanted to ride, my dad said, look, you graduate from high school, if you still want to ride, you can ride. So I wrestled all through high school and learned to lose a little weight, you know, to get down to different weight classes. And so had that part down, but my body didn't cooperate. When I graduated, I was too heavy. So it was never an option. So we kind of had to make a lateral move there on the profession side and figure, well, can't ride, I'll try to train.
I might put you on the spot with this next question just a little bit, Steve, but if you were to pick the one moment in your career that you would consider to be your personal career highlight or the moment you'll never forget, what would it be?
I think December 6, 2014 at Gulfstream Park in the seventh race with Buster Rose.
That was a good one. Now you need to get the win picture.
That's it, yeah. I know it's out there, but it just has to hit the mailbox for us. But that one was pretty special. That one, we've got a lot of emotional and sweat equity in this process with this horse, and I'm very, very awed and humbled at his competitive spirit, and it's been really a blessing for us to be privileged to be around this horse, and he's taught us a lot about a lot of things, I'll tell you.
Well, Steve, only a couple of minutes left before we do have to wrap up this edition of Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton, but I always like to end by asking trainers what other hobbies they might have. And when you are able to get away from the farm and from the races, which I know is extremely rare, what other things do you enjoy doing or do you have interest in?
Well, two things. One of my real guilty pleasure is playing a little golf every now and then. And fishing with my son or my friends, and that's it.
Pretty good golfer?
When I play a lot, I'm okay, but most of the time I just hack it around and just don't get to play enough anymore.
What's the best course you've ever had a chance to play?
Oh gosh, let me think.
Not Valhalla.
Maybe. No, I haven't played Valhalla. haven't played Valhalla. I don't know. Persimmon Ridge, maybe. I don't know. I played a lot of local courses. We try to get on courses where you can get out there, get around, and still get back at feed time.
Steve Dunn here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Steve, that's a great philosophy, and boy, to hear your story has just been so outstanding here tonight. All the best moving forward. Congratulations once again on Buster Rose, and can't thank you enough for spending a little time with us here on Trainer Talk.
Thank you. Thank you for everything and the opportunity to be here, and it was a pleasure.
Absolutely. Steve Dunn here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. You talk about two careers on the opposite end of the spectrum. You look back at the first half of the program tonight and my visit with Ben Colebrook, 35 years old, just really getting started in the business. And then here's Steve Dunn, the veteran. He's been doing it for a while, and you heard him talk about working hard and perseverance and dedication. Obviously a huge family man. His wife Elise by his side through the whole journey. And here he is with Buster Rose, his crowning achievement, as he mentioned, his career highlight to this point, coming this past weekend at Gulfstream Park. Pretty cool. great story. If you don't think the claiming crown means something, just listen to that story. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Don't forget, you can catch a podcast of this program on our website, horseracingradio.net. Listen to all of our Trainer Talk shows, as well as every program we put up there. You can go back and listen right now. All of our interviews available for you at horseracingradio.net. Back with you next Wednesday here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. For Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you then.